Welcome back to Ask a Leader. For this full hour session and beyond, it is my pleasure to bring to you Professor Emeritus in Mathematics at UC Irvine, Dr. Howard Tucker. We're going to not so much be exhaustive of his whole life here, but we would like to look at sort of the shaping of the mind, because Howard Tucker's thinking, it bears a great deal of stock-taking, and that's why we do this legacy interview of sorts. Dr. Howard Tucker was born in 1922 in Lawrence, Kansas, and raised in Hemet, California, after he reached the age of 11. And during he started his scholarly work at UCLA. And we'll talk about the interruption, the several interruptions of that education and academic work in the course of this interview. He joined UC Irvine after several other academic stints around on the mainly on the West Coast. He started at UC Irvine in 1968. He is now, as I said, an emeritus professor of math. His interests have been mainly statistics, statistical math, and probabilities. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Howard Tucker.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on. Well, let's start a little bit with the beginning. You are the progeny of two Eastern European Jews. Can you just say briefly a little bit about both your parents, just very briefly?
Okay. My father was born in the Russian Empire, which is now called Ukraine, and my mother's parents were born in Lithuania and Galicia, the Galicia in southern Poland, and were immigrants to this country in 1902.
And so you have were there brothers and sisters in your family along with you when you were on the scene in Lawrence? Were there siblings?
Oh yes, you mean my siblings?
Your siblings in this family?
I have a younger brother who is 90 years old, and he's professor emeritus from Johns Hopkins. My sister taught high school art for many years and died about 10 years ago.
I see. Okay. Were you close?
Yes, we were all close, I think.
And would you say that your siblings were just, that I'm sure your brother and likely your sister, were they are they as curious as you have always been?
Oh, yes, I think so.
That was fostered in the home setting.
Yes, that was definitely the case.
Well, let's talk about your father was a civil engineer, so he moved from the Midwest into the Southland, California, and then moved the family into Hemet, where he moved away from the civil engineering, the copper mining industry, and he settled into a farm occupation in Hemet.
Yes.
Okay. And you were 11 years old, where you lived out your grade school, the high school days, and then you went on to the University of California at Berkeley.
No, I went first to the University of California at Los Angeles.
That's correct.
Yes.
So
where I spent 2 years.
There you spent 2 years, and then at that point you were drafted. You were called up.
I transferred to Berkeley. And then enlisted in the U.S. Navy in October of 1942.
Okay, and then your career was mainly as in transmission there on New Guinea, through the end of the war.
Yes, well, some islands off the coast of New Guinea
on the Bismarck Archipelago, or is that?
Is the Bismarck. At the end of the Bismarck Archipelago, it's called Manus Island, where Margaret Mead lived to write her book on growing up in New Guinea.
Okay. Well, there. And were you aware of that when you were there?
No, I found out afterwards.
So you were doing your own work. And I it was mentioned, some of you might have seen in the New University Press about over a year ago, they referred to Howard Tucker's having to grit it out with, jungle rot. And I looked it up, and jungle rot is not pretty. But you sort of glide on like none of this stuff really phases you. It's that you were recovering. You had to recover from jungle rot while you were still on the Bismarck Archipelago in New Guinea.
Well, I was in the jungle hospital there for a couple of weeks, two or three weeks, and then it was cured.
Oh, just like that.
Yes.
Well, I want to. We were talking about the shaping of the mind while you were off duty. I mean, you put in your hours during the portion of each day, but when you were not on duty, you made it a point of keeping informed, and you had some very interesting news sources that are. I noticed one of them was out. It finished in 1948. It ended, but I'd like for you to tell us about what you subscribed to and what you were devouring while you were there in service in World War II. Starting with, like, the PM Daily. That's extraordinary.
Yes. Well, I subscribed to two periodicals. One was the newspaper PM that was published in New York by Marshall Field.
And the third.
The third, yes. And that would arrive in bunches of five or seven, depending upon how the mail arrived. And the other one was The Nation, which had a long history and which I still subscribe to. PM, of course, gave up the ghost and in 1948, which was an odd year for it to give up the ghost, but
well, apparently it wasn't. It was very. It was what was foreboding in terms of the political climate. I guess I understood that Marshall Fields III was sort of forced out of running that paper and sort of enticed to get involved with the Sun in Chicago, which is where the PM was coming out, as you told me earlier. So it's a. It was sort of the beginning of the end of the left counterbalance to the right kind of the rightward lemmings rush off the cliff there with the McCarthy era. And so that so you were reading those, and did you know about the PM before you were in the Navy, or how did you find out about that source?
I don't know. It might have been before I went in, because I was associating with people of all sorts of political stripes before I went in, and it might have been sent to me. I don't know, but of course that was it was a glorious time of that magazine. They had brilliant writers,
I think Theodore Geisel, who became Dr. Seuss, I think he was one of the...
That's right.
I'm not sure if that's what you're thinking of.
In PM, there was the Barnaby, which was the first of the cartoons of that type, and I enjoyed that very much.
Were any of your fellow Navy men in service, were any of them interested in your materials that you were receiving every week?
Oh, one of them was slightly.
Slightly.
Yes. And a friend of mine, a man who became a friend of mine while we were there in the Navy.
And so that's, so you were pretty much, you were reading this on your own?
Yes, well, I was reading the periodicals of it. But also, this was a transmitter station that I was at, and where we changed frequencies and changed vacuum tubes when they burned out, these huge, huge vacuum tubes that you don't see anymore. And while sitting there and waiting for all of this, I read somehow this naval base that I was, a small group, about 100 men, were had, there was shipped there most of the books of what was published by the Modern Library, and wow, they were interesting.
Oh, really? Tell us about that.
Well, I read Steinbeck's In Dubious Battle. I read Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. I read, oh, this long novel by Romain Rolland, Jean Christophe, and Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. I read lots of interesting books and enjoyed them all.
And Howard, as we were preparing for this, you spoke about your service had you in, you were conflicted about serving in the military.
Well, I, in the 2 years that I was in at UCLA, I fell among dangerous companions. They were pacifists, and some were Quakers, and some were I forget the the Young People's Socialist League. This was the youth group of the Socialist Party of America. They were very active on campus at the time,
and they were they had your ear. You were very attuned to what they
when I came there, I was there at the ages of 17 and 18, and all ears and all eyes, and so he who has ears, let him hear.
And let's go back to, yes indeed, and let's go back to the age you started your college career at the age of 16 at UCLA. Was there, we know that you are one bright gentleman. Was it so much that you qualified to start early, or was there an effort in World War II to educate the intelligentsia on a faster track, or a little bit of both?
Well, I had emotional difficulties at the time, and I was not doing well grade-wise. But I was doing much better at absorbing the atmosphere, let us put it that way. Later on, especially just before I went into the Navy and afterwards, I got myself sort of straightened out and began to be reasonably good at my studies.
So I'm not going to probe. I just want to ask in general, did you not find your home in the academic setting, or is that what was the emotional part about trying to find the right sort of mix of political academic material, or is it a social issue? Just to be general about it.
It was very personal.
Okay.
I guess.
Okay. I understand. Yeah. So then you were continuing to, as you were talking about, reading such rich materials. When the war was over, then you resumed your studies. You go back to UC Berkeley, correct?
That's right.
And so you talked, in preparation of this interview, you talked about the rarefied setting, which is nowhere recognizable in our time. And that's why we want to look at that in a thoughtful and a deep way, is at the Brentwood Hall at UC Berkeley, that you found a simpatico political sensibilities. Can you talk about life there, what you were exposed to, how you all lived together in that collective of sorts?
Well, I should say that Brentwood Hall era was at UCLA from late 1939 through 1941, and at Brentwood Hall, this was not an university-sponsored or university-recognized place. It was a group of students who got together to make to save on expenses, and some were rather much older. Well, let's call them what they were, radical students who were very interested in everything. And it initially started in 1936 with renting of some old dilapidated homes, large homes, on San Vicente Boulevard in West Los Angeles, and partitioned living rooms into dormitory rooms, and we had a kitchen and hired one cook and the rest of us for $20 a month, and 4 hours of work made through our living expenses. But the intellectual atmosphere was great. This was still during the era of the Great Depression, and jobs, no jobs. So people went to college, lots of people, at least the people I bumped into, because they were interested. And so there were lots of people who were philosophy majors, English lit majors, anthropology, things that had no commercial value, but they were interested in it. And we never could put on a really good social program like what was called in those days a dance, but we did have programs where we would invite a speaker and then discuss what the speaker said, and with arguments then lasting in the rooms till 2 and 3 in the morning. I'll name a few of those.
Please do.
Speakers. One was Bertrand Russell, before he where he spent the fall semester at UCLA before being hired and fired by City College New York. There was Theodore Dreiser, who spoke to us, and we had great discussions long into the wee hours of the morning after any speaker. And we had there were several others that I recalled offhand, but those two were the big names.
You mentioned also in preparation a leading Trotskyist whose name wasn't coming, but there were all kinds of amazing sources coming.
Yes.
To that salon.
Yeah.
of a home.
What's this?
There were so many different.
Yes.
Illuminati coming to the salon of a home where you students congregated.
Yeah, we are sort of like that.
Okay. Were there any women in that group, or this was an all-guy thing? I mean, I know there was no co-ed housing then, but were there any women that were curious and wanting to find out what was being discussed over there at Brentwood?
No, this was just our group.
Okay, just your group.
Yes, these were not public. These were just for the members of the co-op, and so some went and some didn't. It was very informal.
Informal as it was rare with such a
yes.
lineup.
Yes.
Do you miss something like that?
Well, yes. These days, people. It is my general opinion that it is considered in bad taste to bring up controversial subjects. But at that time, and in that group of people, it was especially for a boy 17 and 18 years old. It was a marvelous experience, which of course I enhanced on for the rest of my life.
So I'm sorry I wasn't prudent in the timeline, that all of this intellectual stimulation and fostering of this curiosity, that was before you went into the Navy. So that might have been difficult for you to sort of work with that regimentation in the military as a pacifist.
Oh, yes. Well, I remember when we first came to this Manus Island, sitting on this little dock that the Seabees had improvised within a couple of days, and there were still gunshot firing within a quarter of a mile away.
Okay.
And I kept thinking, these people want to kill each other. I was still just amazed at people's willingness to participate in that sort of thing.
Were you armed?
No.
You were not armed?
Oh, at first they issued us rifles, and I never had I was a poor shot at the bullseye, and I never had to use it, so I never took a life.
Okay. And, oh, no, I never ask a veteran about that.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if you, as a pacifist, were issued a firearm and you were in the where there was active combat, if you were faced with.
See, I was conflicted, and I was very young, and
How old were you at when you arrived at Manus Island?
Oh, I was 19.
That was 19. Wow. Well, let's then talk about when the war was over. And I didn't put in the dateline. Let's find out the date you were married. Well, as you were, we have to acknowledge that milestone in the talking about your shaping your mind. I didn't ask you about that before, but let's include when the year you met your wife, the year you were married, and we can go back into this timeline of shaping of the Howard Tucker mine.
Yes. Well, I was married in 19 the summer of 1946, and we unfortunately were divorced in 1968. And then later, I met my present wife, and we've been married for 32 years now.
Okay. So during those years, that those 46 to 68 lots was happening, and you were under a great deal of academic and political sorts of pressure. Let's talk about when you were working, you were a student at UC Berkeley, and you were a research assistant, or is it a teacher assistant?
Teaching assistant.
You were a teaching assistant, and there was, leading up into 1952, let's talk about leading up to then, what kind of politics were nipping at your heels while you were trying to stay below the radar with your left of center thinking, where it became more and more out of fashion?
I really wasn't trying to stay below the radar. I was very active in the establishment of the Independent Progressive Party that ran Henry Wallace for president in 1948, and did a lot of campaigning along with all my student work. And, of course, we fell flat, but there was lots of... the atmosphere was very anti-Soviet, and we considered it warlike, and we were campaigning against that, and so we campaigned against Truman and for Henry Wallace. And I think, and of course, what Henry Wallace was was championing then, it was actually came into policy by Richard Nixon his presidency.
A brief reference to that, so we can go back to the 50s.
Yes.
What was it that was picked up by Richard Nixon?
What was the what?
What did Richard Nixon pick up that Wallace had campaigned about?
Détente, in one word, was called détente.
Okay, all right. We'll get back to détente.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anti-Soviet discourse before we got to Henry Kissinger and Nixon hatching that. So, but I meant about below the radar that you were going to be considered for. You're putting together your PhD committee and approaching your dissertation as completion, you had to deal with some anti-communist, anti-social sensibilities in appointments and all. So talk about that, would you, Howard?
Yes. Well, there was what was now called the Year of the Oath. That was in 1949. And Regent Neylan, Neylan, proposed this anti-communist loyalty oath, and it was too much for a lot of us who objected to taking a political test. And so out of 200 teaching assistants on the Berkeley campus at that time, it was just 12 of us who refused to sign. And, of course, we were, in a sense, fired. By fired, I mean that that we couldn't accept a reappointment unless we signed that oath. So there I was for 2 years after that without employment, but fortunately there was the GI Bill and the state GI Bill that came in very handy.
So as we talked about this previously, there is an irony here with you have the government taking away and giveth and it taketh away.
Yes,
and
yeah.
So you are, but this is a lot to handle when the dissertation itself has enough of a demand it puts on someone, and you're trying to maintain like a married life kind of a thing. There's this kind of attention is unthinkable to somebody who's trying to work it out this day and age.
Well, so there were some difficulties. And And so for a year, before getting my PhD, I was an instructor at Rutgers University, where they did not have a loyalty oath, we did not overthrow the government by force and violence, which was the expression then.
That was what was used by Regent Neylan.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Neylan, I'm sorry. So then that was a 2 year sort of a disruption of working on your dissertation of sorts.
Well, I had other troubles with my dissertation, in that I had a thesis advisor at first who was an excellent mathematician, but really did not know how to guide a doctoral dissertation, which is something distinct from being a mathematician. And so I changed, and was I could affect the change while I was at Rutgers.
Okay, right.
Jerzy Neyman, a mathematical statistician, became my informal advisor, but my official advisor then, as far as being a student of, was David Blackwell, who was the first African-American to be appointed to a tenured physician at UC Berkeley, and I received my PhD degree then in 1955.
From him. And I want you to backtrack a moment when you were talking about the Chancellor Smiley.
No, this was a regent, Neylan, N-E-Y-L-A-N.
Tell us, though, about what Dr. Smiley had to do how you wanted to follow that up eventually. That's an important piece.
You mean I taught at UC Riverside for 12 years, and the Smiley name came up at that time.
Okay, we'll get to that then. It's 92 years are and it's a phenomenal exercise, a cognitive process to sort out all those years. It's amazing not only that you gone through all that, but I don't have as many years to have to retrieve in the chronology. So this is it's a heady exercise to keep all the years straightened out there. So then you were able to return to your PhD work, and you completed that, as you said, in 1956 at UC Berkeley.
Yes.
1955. After that, what did you decide? What was it you wanted to do? Where did you want to be?
I was always interested in teaching.
Okay.
And I was very interested in mathematics research also. And so at that time, there was pre-Sputnik interest in education, especially technical education, and so jobs were began to be plentiful, and I got a position as an instructor, as an beginning assistant professor at the University of Oregon, and I was there just for 1 year, and then I decided to move to UC Riverside, where I stayed for 12 years from 1956 to 1968.
Okay. All right. And that's where, now we're back to where Smiley came in.
Yes.
It's an interesting saga.
Oh, well, this was an experience that what happened in this case was I was a beginning assistant professor, and this, of course, this is not a tenured position.
Right.
You become tenured if you get promoted to associate professor, and standard time period for assistant professorship is 6 years. So at the end of, toward the end of the 6 years, Smiley was... we had a change of character on the campus from being a four-year liberal arts college to actually being a research university, and there was an eminent algebraist who was hired away from the University of Iowa to come and form a graduate department, and he felt that my research was very good, and my teaching was good, and so he proposed me. Sent a recommendation that I be promoted, and at that time, since my specialty was probability and mathematical statistics, he asked me to recommend a senior faculty member in statistics, and so I told him about someone whom I knew at the University of Missouri named Brunk, and so he got, he made him an offer, and Brunk came to the campus. That was in the fall of 1951, and then in the fall of 1951, late fall, Smiley was visiting our chancellor, who was then Herman Spieth, and Professor Spieth remarked to Smiley that he is rather disappointed with this new hire of a statistician. Smiley asked him, why? And he said, because Brunk is a communist.
And let's backtrack. Spieth was the chancellor.
This chancellor was Herman Spieth.
Spieth. And Smiley was the department chair?
Yes, okay. Smiley was the department chair. Now, I must give you some background on Chancellor Spieth. He was a very conservative person, and I think he was very frightened when he taught for a while at City College of New York. And if you teach at City College of New York when he taught there, and if you were not a raving left-winger, you could get frightened.
Okay,
so
yes.
He was frightened. And so Smiley then asked him, why do you think Brunk is a communist? And he says, well, Tucker recommended him, didn't he? And Smiley said, well, yes. And whereupon he said, Smiley is telling me this long after the thing happened.
Okay.
He says, whereupon the chancellor went to a filing cabinet and took out a folder and had a big file on me of various meetings I had gone to from the year zero after high school to my political activities, and of course they were all very liberal and left wing, and so Smiley was just aghast. Smiley was a conservative Republican type, but he was what we called at that time a Ripon, after the town in Wisconsin.
Oh.
Yes, it was a liberal Republican sort of political attitude. Anyway.
And this folder, this is an FBI folder.
What?
FBI was the source of the collected information. It was an FBI folder that that Spieth had. Was it not? It was an FBI.
No. Oh, yes. Well. There were all sorts of documents in there, including my FBI file, I guess. I used the Freedom of Information Act long afterwards to get it, and it is interesting, but totally uninformative. Anyway. So Smiley was aghast, but Smiley was very wanted me there, and he says, "But what is this going to do to my recommendation of Tucker being promoted and given tenure?" And Chancellor Spieth, who was so rabidly conservative, said, "I will follow the committee's advice, based only on teaching, community service, and research. And those will be the only factors that will influence me." And that was, to me, I've thought about that ever since, how fair he was, because there are stories going around campuses of very unfair treatment. And even though Chancellor Spieth did not like me, he was very fair. And I've often wanted to tell relatives of his, at least, that I respect that fairness of his.
An honorable man, as you said.
Yes.
Yes.
So, see, you can be conservative and you can be a nice guy.
And so you received tenure.
I received tenure, yes.
And then you were at the age of 30. What were you at that age finally? Because there were a lot of interruptions and you're getting to that point. But how old were you then?
Oh, well, this was in 1962 I got tenure, so that I was 40 years old.
40 at that point. And so then after that, is when you moved to UCI, which was a very new UCI.
Well, I moved to UCI in 1968.
Eight, correct.
And it was 62 I got tenure.
Oh, right, right. What brought you to come to UC Irvine?
Well, it might have been just the politics there at Riverside.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure why, but it looked like a good deal to me, and it was an intra-university transfer, actually.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And so I just moved from one campus to the other.
It was more seamless then.
Yes.
Okay. So, a phenomenal stretch here. Did you want to say anything about what was happening during the Korean War, or did you have something special to say about what was happening on the campuses around the Vietnam War?
Oh, well, I was very involved at the Riverside campus during the Vietnam War. I was involved when I first came to Riverside. Well, it was the Civil Rights and the Vietnam War. When I first came to Riverside, it was mostly the Civil Rights Movement. I joined NAACP the first thing I got there, and was very active in that, not only in going to meetings, but most important, picketing supermarkets who on Saturdays that refused to hire African American box boys to box your groceries so you can take them out. And so we picketed these with carrying signs saying, "Don't buy where you can't work." And then, of course, there were other civil rights issues that we went into.
Was Riverside considered a sundown town? I don't know if that term was used then.
Was it
a sundown town where African Americans had to leave town by sundown, or they weren't welcome? I know there were. Anaheim was a sundown town, but I don't know what Riverside had the same distinction.
Riverside has a very large African American community. They were, from what I was told, they were descendants of those brought in to work on the railroads there and in San Bernardino. And segregated schools were built in Riverside, and during my last year there, we not only desegregated the schools, but actually affected busing of students, and I was very active in that as well. And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War that was getting larger, looming larger and larger, and we would read in the newspapers periodically about the names of American boys killed there. I noticed that there were lots of Latino names. This was what was called the poverty draft. They were enlisted men, but enlisted by means because there was you could earn a salary then, and so I was active in some of the student groups, and I was also participated in a silent vigil for peace every Saturday in front of the county courthouse.
What years were those?
Now those were the years between 1963 and 1968. There was a group on campus. It was something about they published the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and I forget the name of the group, two people in the agriculture school, and I formed a chapter of it. And here we had another little conflict with Chancellor Spieth, because we invited Linus Pauling, who was leading a nationwide effort to get to ban above ground nuclear testing because of the strontium 90 found in milk and then being ingested by children. And that was an interesting issue. And
this is when he'd cemented his societally crucial credentials, and he'd already found the bacteria that caused polio and developed a vaccination. So he had quite the cred around, nationally speaking, when he had come forward with this finding up from the nuclear pollution.
Yes, well, I think everybody knew about SR90, but he lent his name
to policy
to banning above ground testing, and finally above ground testing was banned. The what was interesting in that is that the chancellor tried to stop that, and claiming the rule of expertise that policy required political expertise, and Pauling was only a chemist. Of course, he was a Nobel Prize-winning chemist. And then in 1963-64, when I was on sabbatical at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, I read the news. Linus Pauling had won the Nobel Peace Prize, the only person who has ever won two Nobels.
Chemistry and peace. Was it in biology or chemistry he received the first Nobel Prize?
It was chemistry.
Okay. Well,
he was,
medicine, or not biology.
He was a chemist. Yeah. He was a chemistry professor at Caltech at that time.
So Dr. Pauling was able to speak, though. He had the forum.
Yes.
Spieth did not. He did not stop that appearance. So that,
well, he couldn't. Somehow we outmaneuvered him.
Okay, that's key here.
He would have preferred that event did not take place, but it did.
Was it a sort of a headliner that made a lot of difference in a lot of people?
Oh, well, Linus Pauling was big news everywhere.
Okay, so it mattered to a lot of people who may not have been on board before with this nuclear proliferation movement.
I remember another incident at Riverside where we had a little bit of difficulty, and that was with the same chancellor. Namely, I think it was in 1958 or 59, I was chair of the committee to invite speakers, and so a good friend of mine who was circulation librarian there told me that the Library Association had the great African American poet Langston Hughes visiting them, and maybe I could get Langston Hughes there. Well, so we got Langston Hughes, and then all whatever it is broke loose, because Langston Hughes was very radical in the early 1930s, and also he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee at one point. And was asked about his activities and what he was
and his party affiliations.
Yes, on And anyway, they held up the invitation for some time, and then they finally allowed the invitation to go through after we put up a lot of noise about it. And so he came. Our big problem at that point was that a colleague from the music department and I met him. He insisted on arriving there by train at Riverside. This is in about 1958-59.
Yes.
And we took him out to dinner before he spoke. Well, we decided to take him out to the best place in town, which was the Mission Inn.
Righto. Okay.
And there were worries that we had that we would be refused service. We approached the place very cautiously and sat down, and we were not refused service.
Really?
Yes.
This is
so this was in anticipation, I guess, of advances during the civil rights movement.
So that's the progress made since allowing for since the boycotting of the grocery stores that weren't going to hire the African American box boys. So that was the culmination of some of that fomenting.
Yes. Well, Riverside was a racist town, and we were really very worried about whether we could whether they would refuse us service.
Actually, it's my mistake. The Langston Hughes came before you were having those boycotts. Was that or what? In what order were the boycotts?
Oh,
were prior.
Yes. This was before the civil rights era.
Right.
The civil rights era is really by definition the 1960s.
So this preceded that then.
Yes.
And that's extraordinary that there wasn't any kerfuffle then. How did you? We'll back into this for the sort of the longer interview, but how did you? Were you able? With this kind of, it's a very private premises, the Riverside Inn, and it was all about dignitaries and the if elite meeting to eat kind of thing. What? How did you manage to get him in?
Oh, we just walked in, and we had a reservation for three, and they didn't ask us.
That's okay. Like nothing happened.
Yes,
wow.
Yes, nothing happened.
Oh, I want to see the reel-to-reel of that, but that'll never happen. We're going to let our minds.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, so. So I guess in reference to what I was active in the civil rights movement.
Yes.
From 1956 to 59, it was all NAACP work.
Yes,
and,
right.
And then afterwards, there was some NAACP work, some, what was it called, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality.
Okay.
And there was something there that was, I think, strictly local, called the Committee on Open Housing, and picketed various apartment complexes to desegregate.
And the we are colleagues, professors, and their students, or who's the we?
Oh, there were very few academics involved in this.
Okay, you were joining civilians, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
These were townspeople of one sort or another. There was one good friend of mine in the sociology department, but he didn't get tenure, and so he had to move, and so I lost him. But we did what we could.
Was there a synagogue out there, or were there churches that were working on
this? Oh, yes, there were churches, and my church was very active.
Which one was that?
This was the Universalist Unitarian Church of what is now the Unitarian Universalist Congregations, a very picturesque old church in Riverside, and the Reverend Ray Manker, who was a minister when I first got there, was very instrumental in organizing an ACLU chapter, which a bunch of us were charter members of.
Okay.
And as soon as that chapter was formed and made a little noise, the problem of driving while black decreased considerably. People who were of different color were not stopped. We didn't receive that many complaints. I was also affiliated then. It's amazing that I could have done with the community settlement house there, which was a force for integration and fair play and civil rights and civil liberties.
The community settlement house was what?
Well, it was in the minority part of the community where mostly Latinos and African Americans lived. It was a vital force in protecting their rights.
But is this an organization or it's a place where people could
be? It was a place and an organization.
Okay.
It was a big meeting place with, I think, some athletic facilities as well as meeting rooms. So I was part of that, too.
It's phenomenal how much community activism you were sustaining while being a really productive academic. So you had the time management all figured out, Howard, to be able to be so active politically and a productive academician.
Well, I'm very intense, you might say, and very serious, and I was driven by both. I was very, you might say, ambitious in a personal sense for accomplishment, and also there was the question of fairness in human relations, the dignity of the human being, of all human beings, which is, I guess, what I'm always concerned about.
The theology of Howard Tucker.
Yes, the theology of Howard Tucker.